You're a science writer and an investigative journalist and not a nutritionist. So I want to know how you began writing about science and nutrition, because your work has created a lot of controversy within that nutritional establishment.
Okay, well, my college education was in science and physics and engineering, and then I went to journalism school hoping to be an investigative journalist. And frankly, the only job I could get out of journalism school that allowed me to stay in New York City was science writing. So within a few years, I kind of stumbled on the realization that there's a call for investigative journalism even in science, that just like in any other field, there's people who do it well and people who do it poorly, and the people who do it poorly tend not to want others to know they do it poorly, and so there's a place where journalists can step in and do their job. So I've been doing that since the mid-1980s. My first few projects were in the harder sciences, physics, and I had some physics friends suggest that if I was interested in bad science, what they call pathological science, which is the science of things that aren't so, I should look at the stuff in public health, because from their perspective it was, quote, terrible, unquote. So that's what I did. At the beginning of the early 90s, I started looking into some public health issues, in fact, the science was as bad as they had been telling me it was, and I never managed to escape the field. I've been doing it ever since.
What's happened as a result?
Well, late 90s, I got into nutrition, and I assumed from my first project, which was a long investigative article for the journal Science, took me about 9 months to do this one article on salt and blood pressure. I assumed that I would be spending most of my time kind of refuting what the food police tell us to do, because this clearly was based more on wishful thinking than hard science. And as I was doing that, I realized that there was an alternative hypothesis, an alternative way to think about nutrition and health and obesity that you could find in a whole variety of different fields of medicine and nutrition and public health and even anthropology, and that had been kind of pushed aside. And from the 1970s onward, as we focused on, you know, this idea that the low-fat diet is a healthy diet. So by my first big book on the subject, Good Calories, Bad Calories, I had suddenly become, you know, myself into the nutrition business and telling people what I thought were good foods and what I thought were bad foods. And the overall message is, I guess there were two of them. One is that it's not the fat content of our diets that we should be worried about. It's the quantity and quality of carbohydrates we consume, and particularly, as in this last book, sugar. And the second message was that, in a way more profound but very related, we don't get fat because we eat too much or we exercise too little. That obesity is a hormonal dysregulation, for lack of a better term, and that dysregulation is triggered by what we eat, by the types of foods we eat, the macronutrients, not just by the caloric content.
Yes, you wrote Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat. What led you to write this book about sugar, The Case Against Sugar, and what went into the researching and writing of it?
Well, the arguments that came out of Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Got Fat is obesity primarily, and then diabetes and heart disease, again, are triggered by the carbohydrate content of the diet. And that implied that if you want to reverse these conditions, you basically have to eat very low-carb diets, and you replace the diets with fat. So it's low-carb, high-fat diets, which is very similar to what Dr. Atkins has been saying, which is why this has always been a difficult message for the medical community to embrace.
Mm-hmm.
But there was always a problem. If you're going to blame obesity on particularly refined grains and sugars, you've got all of Southeast Asia eating refined grains, and until recently, low levels of obesity and diabetes. So the possible answer to, other than that I'm just wrong, is that they were only eating refined grains, but they were eating very little sugar. So maybe the sugar plays some key factor in this progression from health to obesity and diabetes and all the chronic diseases that associate with it. So, and it turned out through my other research, for instance, back in 2009, I did an article for the journal Science on the mechanisms of insulin resistance. So insulin resistance is this condition where your cells become resistant to insulin, and it's the fundamental defect in type 2 diabetes. So type 1 diabetes, which tends to be a childhood disease and is far more acute, your pancreas fails to produce enough insulin or any insulin at all. In type 2 diabetes, you start off by being resistant to insulin, so your pancreas actually has to produce more and more to get it to do the same job. When I was writing about the mechanisms of insulin resistance, and insulin resistance, the CDC estimates that about 75 million Americans have what's called metabolic syndrome, which is a kind of pre-diabetes or pre-obesity, and is, again, effectively another name for everything that goes wrong once you become insulin resistant. It turned out in talking to the researchers who study insulin resistance that one of the maybe the favored hypothesis is that it's caused by the accumulation of fat in your liver. And one of the things that's clear about metabolizing sugar is that half of sugar is a carbohydrate called fructose, and the fructose is metabolized in the liver and converted often to fat. So you had these lines of evidence that were suggesting that maybe sugar is a unique problem. It's not just like every other refined carbohydrate, but that it's uniquely deleterious, and that's what I'm sort of assessing and analyzing and running my brain around in this book.
Sugar is everywhere. It's part of our holidays, our celebrations. It's in almost all processed food, as far as I can tell. How much sugar do we typically eat as Americans?
Well, it's a surprisingly difficult question to answer. Uh-huh. You could go, the USDA keeps track of what's technically known as sugar availability. And by sugar, I mean both sucrose, which is the white powdered stuff that we put in our coffee, or the brown powdered stuff if you buy it at Whole Foods, and high fructose corn syrup, which is syrup that is used to sweeten most liquids and many pastry products these days. So if you look at the numbers, you could say that, well, we went from about 10 pounds a year, 5 pounds a year, 200 years ago being made available for everyone in the country, to peaking in 1999 when 155, the food industry was selling 155 pounds of sugar, high fructose corn syrup, honey, maple syrup per year in America for every man, woman, child in the country. That's an enormous amount. It's been coming down since 1999. And then the question is, how much of that do we actually consume?
Right.
And the USDA says we only consume, I think, 60% of it, and they have this because the other 40% is lost in processing or is thrown out, at the bottom of a, in the bottom of a cup at your fast food store. It's hard to judge whether that 40% number is accurate or meaningful. So the best answer is we consume a hell of a lot more than we ever did in the past, although we've been coming down since 1999.
It sounds like the amount of sugar consumed has gone up a lot in just a mere 200 years, which for, a whole species of people is a pretty short period of time. How do we know, what is the relationship of obesity, diabetes, heart disease to sugar consumption, and how can we know what's the cause and effect when we're looking at a relationship between an increase in sugar consumption and these things?
Yeah, that's the nub of the issue. We have epidemics worldwide of obesity and diabetes. It's clearly the case. Obesity has been skyrocketing everywhere. Everywhere a population goes from eating their traditional diet to a Western diet and lifestyle, obesity rates and diabetes rates skyrocket. So the idea is that diabetes is caused by the obesity, the common form of diabetes known as type 2, and the obesity is caused by eating too much and exercising too little. And then the obesity and diabetes are also associated with a higher risk of heart disease, of hypertension, of stroke, of cancer, of Alzheimer's, of gout, every chronic disease in effect. And there are different hypotheses for what causes all these things. So we believe that the saturated fat content, the trans fat content of the diet that pushes heart disease rates up, and we believe it's like the meat content and the alcohol content that pushes gout up, and we think it's salt that makes hypertension rates increase in these Western diets. So it's a kind of bucket full of possible explanations when you start eating a Western diet. It could be true. What I'm arguing in the book is that obesity and diabetes and hypertension, heart disease, and all these diseases are so closely associated, both in populations and in individuals, that the best scientific approach is to assume that they're all caused by the same thing, one thing, not six or seven different things that are all, and not just the Western diet or not just processed foods, but one element of the Western diet and lifestyle, one element of processed foods. And if it turns out that's not, you can't explain what's going on with us, the simplest possible explanation, then you go to a modification of the simplest. You add another factor. And as I explore in the book, you can pretty much explain everything we see, including heart disease and hypertension and gout and obesity and diabetes, by mechanisms that have been well established with sugar in the diet. I hope I'm wrong, because we all love sugar. But
you know, there have been recently some stories regarding the role of the sugar industry in obscuring sugars. Well, there's some serious health effects associated with eating sugar. They haven't actually been saying that sugar is good for us, but they have said that sugar is empty calories that can fit into your diet as long as you aren't eating too many calories overall. You know, what's the truth there?
Well, that's the point. We've had this, what I now consider this almost incomprehensibly naive notion that we get fat because we consume too many calories. And it's funny, it's completely ubiquitous, even in medical research. Anytime you see a phrase like overconsumption or excess, I often bridle, even when I'd be talking to allies, and they say, well, you know, excessive sugar consumption causes disease. And I say, well, once you say excessive, right, it's got to cause something. It's kind of a tautology. You would never say too much cigarette smoking causes lung cancer or excessive cigarette smoking causes lung cancer. We just say cigarettes cause lung cancer. And there might be a level you can smoke where the risk of lung cancer is so small that you might say it's safe below that level, but you would never use words like too much and excessive and over smoking. Oh, yeah, Taub's got lung cancer because he oversmoked. It's just in nutrition, this thinking is so interwoven. And what I point out in my books and is that until the 1940s, all the best science was done in Europe. It sounds unpatriotic to say that, but it's just clearly the case. The German and Austrian researchers pioneered virtually every major field of medicine leading up to, you know, 1930s it peaked, and then the war kind of decimated these communities, and in some areas like physics, they all, when they fled to the U.S., these brilliant European researchers, many of them Jews, we embraced them because we had a Cold War to fight and bombs to build, but medicine and public health, we didn't want anything to do with these people, and nutrition, and their ideas pretty much died with the war, and pre-World War II, they were convinced that clinical investigators in Europe had come to be convinced that obesity was a hormonal problem. And then this idea kind of vanishes, and in the 1960s, the tools were available to actually study what regulates fat accumulation in the human body, like what tells a fat cell whether or not to take up fat and hold on to it. And it turns out that this process is driven by the hormone insulin. So again, we've already talked about sugar causing insulin resistance. If you actually look at this other line of research, if sugar causes insulin resistance, that raises insulin levels because your pancreas has to secrete more insulin to deal with the carbohydrates you're eating. So now you have elevated insulin. When your insulin is elevated, that's signaling your fat cells to take up fat and hold on to that fat. Mm-hmm. And it's signaling your lean tissue to burn carbohydrates for fuel, not fat. So you basically have created a hormonal milieu in your body that's signaling your cells to store fat and store fat and store fat and not burn it. And this is textbook science.
And it's been around a while.
It's been around. But because we believe, we keep saying obesity is a calorie issue, you eat too much, we ignore the textbook science. It's, again, I clearly recognize that the more I talk about it, the more insane it seems to me. I think this is a common problem with all quacks. It boggles my mind. And when I give lectures, I have slides from the seminal, the premier biochemistry textbook and the premier endocrinology textbook. And in both of them, if you look at why fat cells get fat, it explains that it's completely insulin and blood sugar-driven phenomena. And then if you look at why humans get fat, and they both have sections on human obesity, they'll say it's because we take in more calories than we expend. It's like, pick one or the other, but you can't have it both ways. And my argument is just whatever makes a fat cell fat is going to be the same thing that makes us fat because we're just an accumulation of all our fat cells.
Now, we start out as kids eating, actually, I would say most kids eat quite a bit of sugar, and maybe people eat a little bit less as they get older and their tastes change. How about our kids? I find part of your book where you said that it's possible that insulin resistance can be passed down from a mother to an infant really disturbing. And we know childhood obesity and even childhood fatty liver disease are rising. And our kids are so important, but they're surrounded by sugar even more than we are as adults. How does sugar affect them, and what can we do about that?
Well, that's the issue, isn't it? And the answer is we really don't know. And again, part of the reason we don't know is because of this naive conception that it's just about calories. So as long as your kids are exercising and they're not overweight, they're not eating too much, and it doesn't matter what they eat. Although simultaneously we would all say, well, don't let them eat as much sugar as they want. There's that issue. There's this issue of whether or not it's addictive and what it's doing to their brains or might do to their brains. And clearly my writing this book was informed throughout by the fact that I'm a parent and I have two boys, you know, who have yet to hit puberty. And I feel like I spend an inordinate amount of my life managing their sugar consumption and what may be their mood swings that result, and I don't know if that's true or not because we never did the research to find out, or good research. As I discuss in the book in a chapter called the if-then problem, the first of two if-then problems, if sugar causes insulin resistance, that's the assumption that we're analyzing throughout this book, then the effects of sugar consumption are going to be passed down from mother to child in the womb. And we are likely to, with each generation, create children who are actually, you know, respond worse to sugar-rich environments than better. Although, again, it's hard to say. So, and you could see this clearly in Native American populations, particularly a population called the Pima that have been studied by the NIH for about 50 years, where each generation develops diabetes earlier and earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Based in part on whether or not the mother is diabetic or gestationally diabetic or obese when she's pregnant. So you have this issue where we might be giving each generation of Americans might be more susceptible to the sugars in the diet and that they're more quickly going to drive them to obesity and diabetes. and may be driven that way even without the sugars of the diet because of the sugars that their mothers and grandmothers consumed. And it's a very dismaying sort of vicious cycle. And the only thing I can say for sure is as long as we blame all these conditions on calories in and calories out and say things like a calorie is a calorie, we're doing a horrible disservice to the evidence and the science and to future generations of Americans. They're going to be blamed, their characters are going to be blamed for their obesity and their diabetes rather than their biology.
Do you think there is a safe level of sugar consumption? It's gone up a lot in 200 years, yeah. But...
Well, there's clearly a safe level for some people. That's the problem. You know, what's safe for me may not be safe for you, and there's very little way to tell. And then what may be safe today, so say I'm 18, I can tolerate, a Coca-Cola a day, I may not be able to tolerate when I'm 30 or 40 or 50. In part, I would say, not because my metabolism's slowing down, but because of the effect of the sugars on this insulin-resistant status. So you might measure someone's, you could look to see if they have this condition called metabolic syndrome by measuring their, well, are they getting fatter, or is their HDL, their good cholesterol, low, a variable called triglycerides, are they high, a few other factors. You might say, well, you know, Jane doesn't have metabolic syndrome, so clearly she's okay with consuming sugar. But you don't know if she's on her way to getting metabolic syndrome because of the sugar she's consuming, you know, on their way to becoming insulin resistant. It's sort of hard to do these kinds of assessments. So the answer is I don't know. I mean, clearly it brings us an enormous amount of joy without the kind of negative consequences, immediate negative consequences that other drugs of abuse do. One of my favorite short stories in the book is back in the 1920s when British Medical Journal equated sugar consumption to being as bad as alcohol consumption. And an American professor said, yeah, it may be true, but I've never known someone to come home after having like an ice cream binge and beat his wife. So yeah, I would love there to be some safe level, but I couldn't tell you what it is for me. And I know that me personally, I find it a lot easier not to eat any of it than to try and moderate my consumption.
Your work has made a difference, I think, in the nutritional establishment over time. It started with, you did the piece on salt, you've done things on fats, you've talked in your work about carbohydrates. Do you feel, from your vantage point, that the recommendations that the nutritionists and doctors are giving to people are starting to change about what we should be eating?
Well, they're clearly starting to change. I don't know how much of it I did get any credit for, whether it might have changed had I never done a single thing I'd done. I was pointing out that the evidence was inadequate for what we believed 15 and 20 years ago was so, and now other people have concluded the evidence is inadequate. They might have done so without me. They might have even done it faster if they weren't, you know, pissed off by my articles. So there's two things happening. One is that the guidelines in some organizations are moving in what I think are the right direction. So they're getting a little more savvy about the salt guidelines, although they're not there nearly yet to where I would be. The USDA recent dietary guidelines relaxed its cap on the percentage of fat in a healthy diet, but I still think their idea that you should replace saturated fat with, you know, animal fats in effect with vegetable oils is based on bad science and potentially dangerous advice. But so we're converging towards some similar areas, and that's a good thing, although it could take, whether or not we'd ever get to where I think the nation should be, you know, I'm king of the universe, I get to decide, that's probably never going to happen. The other thing that's happening, which I find more encouraging, is that physicians are embracing this sort of belief system, for lack of a better word, where you're targeting the carbohydrates. And there are certainly many hundreds and maybe quite a few thousands in the country today who, if they see a patient who's obese or diabetic or has metabolic syndrome, are going to recommend that they cut out the carbohydrates they're consuming and replace them with healthy fat, however you define that. And this is a sea change from what would have been recommended 20 years ago. And it's an enormous relative increase from 20 years ago. It still represents a tiny percentage of the medical community. But these people are now out there. They're relatively easy to find. There's a lot of them. And they say things to me like, and one of the greatest compliments anyone ever gave me was an Arizona physician who said, "You made medicine fun for me again, because I can make my patients healthy. I'm not just prescribing drugs for their symptoms, writing statin prescriptions 10 times a day. I'm actually making my patients healthier, and I could see them get healthy with each subsequent visit." So I think that's what encourages me the most, is I think as other physicians realize the sort of what they would call the clinical efficacy of this dietary approach, I think more and more of them will embrace it. But how long it takes to get to a tipping point, or whether we ever will, I don't know. But what I see is really encouraging.
Congratulations on that. That must make you feel pretty proud of the work that you've done and its impact on people.
I don't know if proud is the first word. It keeps me going.
How has this book been received?
The Sugar Book has been terrific. I mean, it's taken a while, and maybe it's because sugarcoated the message in a book about, again, sugar, and no one wants to criticize a book that's arguing that we shouldn't eat sugar. None of the nutritional authorities. In fact, I'm waiting for one of them who sort of very knee-jerk has always, every time I wrote anything, within 36 hours he would write something explaining why I'm wrong and why he's smarter than I am. And I'm still waiting for him to do this on the Sugar Book. And
your takedown, yeah.
The reviews from major sources have been terrific. The Atlantic had a writer for Slate do a terrific, very thoughtful review critique, and his criticisms, much as they made me squirm, were pretty good.
Uh-huh.
I said I wished I had asked him to read the book in draft so I could have fixed them before publication. The Wall Street Journal had a wonderful review. The New York Times book review had a very positive, thoughtful review that's going to be on the cover of this Sunday's book review. And the British press, The Guardian, several other publications have done really thoughtful reviews, embracing not just the message of the book, but some of the messages that I've been trying to convey over the years. So.
You know, that article in The Guardian, I think I read that, and it started with kids in the future watching some movie where other kids in the past were making sugary things and eating them, and that these kids were aghast that children would be actually eating such a poisonous substance. Sugar. Yeah. And do you think that day will ever come?
I mean, it's possible. We're certainly getting, we're moving in that direction. And I think I have no doubt that the food industry sees the writing on the wall. They may try to delay it as long as they can. And one of the problems is sugar is an extremely useful substance in foods as a preservative for text. I mean, it does a dozen different things that's hard to replace. But I think they clearly see where we're going. And whether we get to that future, that'll be interesting. But a friend of mine had a different, related but different thought experiment, because one of the things I'm addressing in this book, again, is this epidemic of diabetes, which went from an excruciatingly rare disease in the 19th century to a one in 11 Americans having diabetes today. And my friend named Bob Kaplan in Boston, Bob said, imagine if 50 years from now, 1 in 11 Americans had multiple sclerosis or ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And we were just assuming that it was because of their behavior and some vague profit-mongering in the food industry. I mean, it would be, you can't even imagine that, and yet that's pretty much the same scenario that's happened with diabetes. So maybe we'll wise up.
Well, congratulations on your book, and it is The Case Against Sugar. It's published by Penguin Random House, and thanks for talking with me today.
It's my pleasure.